What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks. We will spend our full hour today talking about Palestine. Our guest today is Curry Peterson-Smith, Michael Ratner Middle East Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he researches U.S. empire, borders, and migration. Good morning, Curry.
Good morning, Kat.
Thank you for coming back on the show. Curry, I want to start the way that we always do, and that is with your reflection on the numbers. According to the Ministry of Health, at least 31,112 people have been killed. I say at least because we know that is very likely an undercount, and there doesn't seem to be an end in sight. Your thoughts?
Well, yeah, unfortunately, that is not only is that true, but as many agencies, UN agencies, as well as, you know, humanitarian agencies have pointed out, that there are long-term effects and impacts of the destruction of Gaza, as well as the depriving of the population of food and, you know, water for hygiene and things like that, that we know are going to, this is really just the beginning of an unfolding public health crisis. So the 31,000 people who have been killed, that figure is largely attributed, it's overwhelmingly attributed to bombing and shelling. But because Gazans do not have access to clean water, because they do not have access to food, we know that disease is spreading, infectious disease is rampant. We know that starvation is setting in, and that is a process that unfolds in the human body. And it's a cumulative process. And so we desperately, desperately need this ceasefire. And we know that if there was a ceasefire today, there are still so many people in grave danger of death from those other things, which is why I think it's really important to hammer the fact that in addition to the ceasefire, we need the U.S. to restore funding to UNRWA, the UN agency, the only UN agency, the only agency in the world capable of actually even beginning to attend to the humanitarian needs of Palestinians in Gaza as well.
I want to talk a little bit more about Israel's intentional starving of Palestinians. We've heard things like people are grinding up animal feed in order to eat. Can you paint a more specific picture of how bad things are on the ground in relation to this?
Yeah, and it varies a bit across the strip. You know, as we know, Israel said early on that they very aggressively displaced people from northern Gaza and pushed the majority of the population to the south. But a lot of people remain in the north, and Israel has really laid siege to Gaza City and the towns surrounding it so that infrastructure has just been shattered. And they've also made it basically impossible for aid groups to reach that area in particular. And we have reports of the Israeli military firing on aid workers, in addition to medical personnel. And so that's where in many ways, the most desperate situation is. That's where you do have people grinding animal feed and trying to make a kind of flour out of it. But it's really not edible. People are foraging for eating plants that previously had not been eaten, but they're just trying to gather some nutrition from somewhere. And then in the south, you know, in Rafah in particular, that's where the greatest concentration of aid and resources is at the moment. But it's misleading because Israel has stopped the flow of trucks to a real trickle, and it just means that those agencies are not able to actually feed people. They are working to shelter people, but of course the schools and shelters and hospitals where folks are trying to shelter are also subject to Israeli bombardment. So it's really just a catastrophic, apocalyptic situation.
We've also heard in regards to the starvation, the particular impact that it's having on children, mothers who can no longer nurse. Just when you think about the vulnerability of children's bodies not having access to nutrition.
Well, that's extremely important. And again, here it's important not only to talk about what it means to go hungry today, but to be hungry for weeks and longer, you know, to be deprived of food for months. It has a cumulative impact on the body, such that, you know, of course, and I know that we'll get into this, the Biden administration is trying to throw a bone to our movement here by saying, oh, but look, we're airdropping food, which other countries started doing first, by the way, like Jordan. But what they are airdropping, you know, when somebody, and particularly when a child has been starved, they can't just eat a regular meal. You know, medical professionals need to guide their recovery. I mean, they require a medical recovery. It's not just about feeding hungry people, the people who are most severely impacted, who are starving. And so it's really important to attend to that human reality of what Israel is doing. And again, it shines a light on why the Biden administration's response is not only inadequate, it's part of the starvation of these children.
And Curry, this almost feels ridiculous to say, but this, among many other things, is absolutely considered a war crime, correct?
Absolutely. I mean, and I appreciate you saying it because, you know, I was just listening to the Times of Israel does a podcast every day, and they had their diplomatic correspondent kind of lamenting the criticism that Israel is getting in the U.S. and around the world. And he said, you know, they accuse us of war crimes, but they can't point to what war crimes. Well, there's many specific war crimes actually that Israel's committing, whether it is targeting medical facilities and medical personnel to, yes, among the earlier provisions in international law and human rights conventions is that an occupying power is legally responsible, not just morally responsible, but legally responsible for the population that it occupies. And that means making sure that that population has food, has water, has fuel, and has medical access to medical needs. And again, this isn't just about month five. This is about day one. You know, Yoav Gallant, the defense minister, the Israeli defense minister, said in a televised address, we are denying these people food and water and fuel and electricity. And he said that in the same sentence that he called people of Gaza human animals, said that we're going to treat them accordingly. So that's not only that's dehumanizing, but the dehumanizing rhetoric was meant as a package to justify what is a legal war crime, which is depriving the population that Israel occupies of its most basic needs.
And then, Curry, something that I've meant to ask you when we've talked about the things Israel is doing as war crimes before is, okay, it's a war crime. What does that mean in terms of potential consequences?
Right. Well, and this is really what's playing out right now at the International Court of Justice and in the UN General Assembly and in various other multilateral bodies and in the capitals of countries around the world. Because what is international law? Like, what is the international law that the ICJ presides over? this is a set of conventions that every state is party to. Like, it's not so much that Israel is on trial because Israel has certain obligations. The proceedings at the international law, I mean, that's true, but the proceedings at the International Court of Justice are pointing to the fact that all member states, all UN member states, actually have legal obligations. Not, again, not just moral or ethical obligations, but legal obligations if they see the violation of international conventions. And so what does that mean concretely in terms of consequences? It could mean recalling your ambassador, as Bolivia has done from Israel. It could mean an arms embargo, saying that Israel should not be receiving any weapons, which a number of countries are exploring. The Netherlands, for example, has taken steps toward, as well as Spain. There's any number of ways that member states can make real or make concrete their obligations, their legal obligations under international law.
You touched on it briefly, and we've talked about it before, but the spread of contagious diseases like COVID, with people being cramped, you know, into what is left of infrastructure because their homes have been destroyed. How bad have those conditions gotten?
Incredibly bad. And there's any number. I mean, we can all imagine, you know, the diseases that are spreading. It's winter, you know, it's winter here, it's winter there, it's winter in Gaza too. And so it's cold, people are without shelter, etc. The big one that aid groups are pointing to is hepatitis. There's a big spread of hepatitis at the moment, which, as we know, has long-term, I mean, it's a kind of disease that is deadly, but for people who survive it, it has long-term impacts on the body. And this is, again, this is really an incredibly preventable infectious disease that's all about the question of hygiene and sanitary conditions. And that is what Israel is denying. And, you know, on one hand, it is the case that aid groups, if given the opportunity, could actually provide, they could provide services that would really alleviate the kind of acute problems here. I think a lot about the fact that when there was that brief, what they called humanitarian pause back in the fall, it was kind of incredible how quickly actually the constellation of aid organizations was able to get hospitals back up and running, was able to get people fed and get all kinds of needs into the Gaza Strip. So on one hand, there, you know, if we have a ceasefire, there could be an immediate impact. On the other hand, if we look at what has produced this public health crisis, we're talking about the destruction of Gaza's plumbing infrastructure, right? I mean, there's no kind of permanent sanitary, water infrastructure. All that has to be rebuilt. So this is really about making Gaza unlivable. At the end of the day, that's what this bombardment is about. It's not really about hostages, which Israeli military operations have not freed. They've freed two hostages in 5 months. That's not what this is about. This is about making Gaza unlivable for Palestinians.
Curry, today marks the beginning of Ramadan. What does it mean to celebrate this holiday in the middle of a genocide?
Yeah. Well, you know, I'll start with Ramadan Kareem to, you know, my Muslim fam. I'm not a practicing Muslim, although I have great respect and I'm grateful and honored to be in deep community and kinship with Muslim fam. And so I know that somebody who practices can answer that question better than I, but, you know, what I can say, what anybody who can see and who's paying attention can say is that this is such a desecration of the holiest month of the year in the Muslim calendar. It's an affront to any, I mean, in addition to just the dehumanization of Palestinians, this is an affront to any person of faith, in my opinion, or any person who holds human life as sacred. You know, this is an affront to all of that. About Ramadan in particular, as we know, this place, Palestine, is a particularly holy land. And as we know, Jerusalem has some sites in particular that are incredibly important to Islam. And as we know, actually every Ramadan, Israeli forces, Israeli police, and the Israeli military, they restrict the number of people who can go to the Al-Aqsa Mosque. They harass people going to the mosque. They have been known to invade the mosque during Ramadan. The Minister of National Security right now, Itamar Ben-Gvir, is somebody who has made it very clear that he has utter contempt for Palestinians, utter contempt for Muslims. He is an open and enthusiastic Jewish supremacist. And so we know there will be provocations of Palestinians during Ramadan. And so as horrific as what's happening in Gaza right now is, I'm sorry to say that at the moment, what we can anticipate is an escalation. You know, they're escalating in Lebanon, and they are primed to escalate in Jerusalem. And I will say again, if the U.S. actually said we are going to stop the flow of weapons to Israel, that is the one thing that I think could lead to an Israeli de-escalation across the board in Gaza, in Lebanon, and in Jerusalem. Short of that, I think that they essentially have the green light from the White House to do whatever they want. And therefore, Biden is, and you know, the U.S. officials that have been supporting this are party to the desecration of Ramadan that we are seeing and that the Israelis have planned.
And in fact, we saw last night Israeli soldiers beat Palestinians who were trying to worship at the mosque. And certainly there's a fear of an uptick in violence that I can't even begin to imagine what uptick would mean. I guess the other thing that I'm thinking about is, as we mentioned, people are already starving. And during Ramadan, folks fast from sunup to sundown. And I don't...
Right.
Yeah, I guess I'm just trying to wrap my head around that.
Yeah, I mean, what... You know, there are provisions and understandings, you know, within fasting that you know, one needn't fast in the midst of medical, you know, if there are health reasons not to. But the question remains, what does it mean, you know, in a holy month that is about centering spiritually, you know, and deepening one's spiritual connection, and fasting as such an important aspect of that in Islam? What does it mean to fast in a population that's being starved? You know, I think that this is, you know, it's a question for Muslim folks, but it's a question for all of us. And it really gets at the kind of world that Israel is trying to pull us into now. Do you know what I mean? And what they're trying to normalize. And we have to resist it.
Curry, you mentioned the United States, you know, says that it's airdropping food. There are now rumors that the U.S. and the EU are trying to establish maritime routes to get aid to Gaza and evade the land restrictions put in place by Israel. Do you think that that has the possibility of being successful? And is it too little too late?
So this is very interesting, because Biden has put this forward as a kind of novel idea that given this humanitarian crisis in Gaza, we can use the U.S. military and its know-how to build this pier and get aid to Gaza. There's a lot of problems with this. The first is, what does it mean to the overwhelming heft of the U.S. military apparatus, its logistics, you know, all of that. Overwhelmingly, it's going to sending Israel weapons. Like, it's the U.S. military apparatus that is creating the crisis. You know, this isn't just like private companies like Boeing and General Dynamics are making weapons and then, you know, getting it to Israel via like FedEx. This is the U.S. It's the Pentagon, the Transportation Command, that is it's using the Department of Defense's systems to get those weapons to Israel. And so the idea that, yeah, we're going to spend the overwhelming majority of our energy on supporting the bombing of you, but we'll also devote some of our logistics to giving you some food. It's just, it's absolutely unacceptable. And it really, frankly, that's the Israeli framework. I mean, that's what Israel's been saying. Oh, we've been letting aid into Gaza. Yeah, sure. We have severely limited the number of trucks that we allow in, which wasn't enough anyway. But we're letting it. Hey, yeah, we bombed this hospital, but well, we brought in some incubators afterward. I mean, this is about a photo opportunity. It's about public relations. If you want to stop the starvation and stop the crisis, stop the bombing and have a ceasefire. So that's the first thing. But the second thing is that the aid agency that is capable, once again, of actually feeding the people of Gaza, of taking, you know, attending to their medical needs and all their other needs, is UNRWA, the UN Palestinian Relief Agency. And the United States defunded UNRWA. And more significant than the actual dollar amount of what the U.S. is withholding, when the most powerful country in the world says that this is not a legitimate or credible organization and we're going to stop our funding, that set an example for more than a dozen other countries to follow suit. And now UNRWA is in crisis, right? So if the U.S., if the White House was actually serious about attending to Palestinians' humanitarian needs, there's a fairly simple fix for that. Call a ceasefire and also restore aid to UNRWA. The last thing, though, and this is really interesting, is that this idea of building a pier off the coast of Gaza, it's not a new idea. Actually, this was floated several years ago within the Israeli political establishment by this guy, Yisrael Katz, who is now he now works in the Israeli transport ministry. And this idea was put forward within the Israeli government several years ago, and Israel basically passed on it, the idea of having a pier off the coast of Gaza that could be a conduit for aid. A couple months ago, Yisrael Katz presented the same idea to the European Union when the EU had a meeting with him to talk about this crisis in Gaza, and he said, oh, I've got this idea for this pier off the coast. And they said, that's not what we want to talk about. We want to talk to you about a ceasefire. And so it was basically kind of laughed out of the room. Now Biden is taking the same idea that's been rejected by the Israelis, it's been rejected by the EU, but now the US is putting it forward. It's not a new idea. It's a bad idea. It's about PR, and it's totally cynical.
And in a speech over the weekend, we heard President Biden say that the invasion of Rafah is a red line. And he also said, finally, that he wants to see a ceasefire. Your thoughts? First of all, why is Rafah the red line? Why is that the final straw and not 31,000 dead people? And your thoughts that he said he wants to see a ceasefire? Why the change in tune?
Yeah, so, you know, one thing just to say, he quote unquote clarified his remarks and said, well, it's not really a red line, you know. So he kind of On one hand, he said he didn't want to see the operation go forward in Rafah, but he stuck to the frame that he's been using for a while, which is that Netanyahu needs to pay more attention to the civilian deaths. So there's kind of more. He's less enthusiastic about the kind of just slaughter, but the rhetoric really, you know, it really hasn't. Even the rhetoric is not sufficient. It's worth noting that the rhetoric from the UK's prime minister, for example, from the German prime minister, from any number of ministers around the world, of course, from the president of Brazil and Colombia and Bolivia, you know, are far more critical and are actually calling for a ceasefire and are more adamant about that. So what Biden is saying, and even what Kamala Harris, who went a little further, she at least called for the kind of 6-week temporary, you know, pause, which they are now calling a ceasefire. This is on one hand a difference from what they've said in the past, and yet it's far behind what other heads of state are saying around the world. That said, of course, the big question is not just what Biden is saying, but what Biden is doing. And not only have they not announced any plans to stop the U.S. from vetoing ceasefire resolutions and other resolutions in the UN Security Council, or voting against resolutions in the UN General Assembly, but they have also not announced any plans of stopping the flow of weapons. And on the contrary, the approval process to approve more weapons is working its way through the State Department right now. You know, the Washington Post reported last week that the U.S. has sent weapons to Israel more than 100 times since October 7th. Wow. You know, 100 separate times that the U.S. has approved weapons to be sent. And so they are in the process of approving more. And so whatever Biden is saying rhetorically, the big question is, what is he doing? And at the moment, they're not changing the policy.
Let's talk about Rafah for a moment, Curry. First of all, it's a misnomer, to say the least, that they haven't invaded, right? I mean, they're bombing Rafah. That is happening.
That's right.
It's the ground invasion that we've sort of all are bracing ourselves for. Rafah borders Egypt. Initially, they lined up tanks to ensure that people were not pushed into their borders due to Israeli bombardment. What's the tension like there?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I'm so glad that you said they're bombing Rafah. I mean, they just bombed a 12-story apartment building in Rafah. They leveled it, brought it to the ground, you know. So yeah, they're not sending tanks into the city and doing block by block combat. But they are bombing from the sky and they're shelling from tanks on the edges of the city. There is this tension with Egypt because, first of all, it's worth saying, just by way of background, you know, Israel has, of course, blockaded Gaza well before October 7th for years. And Egypt was party to that blockade. You know, Israel controls two land borders with Gaza, and they control the sea, the Mediterranean Sea, the coast, off the coast of Gaza. But Egypt controls the fourth part of that rectangle, that is the Gaza Strip. And Egypt at any moment could have ended this blockade by opening that border and letting goods flow in and letting people come and go as they please. And Egypt has opted not to do that. They have been one of the jailers of Gaza. And so right now, yes, the Egyptian state has been bracing itself for Palestinians from Rafah to be displaced across the border into Egypt, which they've made clear they do not want. They have threatened Israel that if they try to displace Palestinians into Egypt, that Egypt will pull out of the 1979 quote-unquote peace accords that were hammered out at Camp David. This was the first treaty that was signed between Israel and an Arab state, so it has a very historic significance. It was after that Egypt achieved a special status with the United States. You know, Israel has been, of course, the number one recipient of U.S. aid in the world, and in particular in the Middle East. For many years, Egypt was number two. And that was because it was willing to sign this treaty with Israel in 1979. By threatening to back out of that, Egypt is therefore playing a pretty high card, or they're threatening to play a pretty high card that would not only have implications for its relations with Israel, but also for its relations with the United States. But they do not want a million Palestinian refugees. They never have. And Egypt is actually unique in the neighbors of Palestine in that they don't really have a refugee population. Syria does, Lebanon does, Jordan certainly does. Egypt made clear from jump, you know, we don't want Palestinians here. And they're essentially continuing that policy. And it has meant that it's meant incredible violence. I mean, they just built a wall, essentially, kind of on the other side of the border, so that if any Palestinians do get displaced, there's only so far that they can go into Egypt's territory.
And then finally, Curry, I mean, we spend most of our time, you know, talking about Gaza and sometimes forget to talk about the West Bank, which is also under intense assault by Israel. Updates on how things are in that part of the region.
Yeah, it's really horrific, you know, and it is a combination of the Israeli military as well as Israeli settlers who have been given an absolute green light to terrorize, both the military and the settlers have been given a green light to terrorize Palestinians and really do, you know, a version of what Israel is doing throughout its territory, in Gaza, within its borders, in Jerusalem, and in the West Bank, which is steal Palestinian land and displace Palestinians from that land. And so they have driven, settlers have driven folks out of their homes in the West Bank. The military has been carrying out very intense operations, including bombing, including airstrikes, actually, in the West Bank. There are villages and neighborhoods in towns in the West Bank that Palestinians are saying, this looks like Gaza, actually, you know, like that level of destruction, all under the pretext of fighting Hamas. And so it's a really horrific situation in the West Bank. And it is the case that while the world's attention is rightly focused on just the acute and severe genocide in Gaza, basically the Israeli military and settlers are taking advantage of that to run amok in the West Bank.
And actually, I lied. One more question. We also see violence continuing between Lebanon and Israel. Over the weekend, Hezbollah launched rockets into the Israeli village of Meron after Israeli strikes killed five people in southern Lebanon. How is that impacting the dynamics in terms of the genocide in Gaza? We spoke previously about the fact that a war on two fronts is not sustainable for Israel. So wondering if you see an end game here.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the people at the wheel in Israel right now are going for broke. I mean, they want... They're doing this set of operations in Gaza, of course they don't really. I mean, that's the main area of focus, you know, to speak about it euphemistically. And even with that, they don't have an end game really. I mean, they're like, well, you know, we will maintain once the day after the war, which, you know, does not seem to be, which is, first of all, is not a war, and secondly, does not seem to be ending anytime soon. You know, but there's this kind of bizarre Israeli discourse of the quote-unquote day after. And they say, well, you know, Hamas can no longer be in power. Israel will still be in control militarily. And then there'll be some other Palestinian civilian entity that is not the current Palestinian Authority, but something else that will somehow be in control. So that's vague, what they've got with Gaza. With Lebanon, it seems wildly open-ended. They are saying, you know, they want to go after Hezbollah. They have not only been carrying out these attacks on the border with Lebanon, but deep into Lebanese territory, including assassination in Beirut and elsewhere in the country. And again, the Israeli conversation is, they're very clear. They're like, we're going to win in Gaza, and then we're going to Lebanon. I mean, they have no intention of stopping anytime soon. And so the only end game in sight really is winning the ceasefire. I mean, this again speaks to why a permanent and immediate ceasefire is so important. Yes, it is about stopping the genocide in Gaza, but it's about the whole, Israel is trying to carry out an open-ended just pursuit of fights. They're bombing Syria, by the way, regularly. I think the only thing that can stop this is a ceasefire, and that's why what we do here in the United States is so important, because again, it's the U.S. that is giving the green light diplomatically, and it's the U.S. that is supplying the weapons. And so that's really the only hope here. Israel is prepared to go for this in an open-ended way until we stop them, and so we must.
All right, Curry Peterson Smith, always a pleasure talking to you, though we never talk about anything pleasurable. Thank you so much for coming on the show today and for your work.
I'm so grateful, Kat. Thank you.
We've been speaking to Curry Peterson Smith, Michael Ratner Middle East Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he researches the U.S. empire, borders, and migration.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fortnox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA, that's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener, and if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.